Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who's Wise made for? It's made for jet setters and slow travelers, for online marketplaces and real-life bazaars, for business in the city and pleasure on the coast. Wise is made for studying abroad and supporting your little brother's schooling back home. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
Turmoil in Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blinks in a battle over the judiciary, but many simply don't trust him.
There are quite a lot of people who now understand that Netanyahu is doing what is good for Netanyahu.
Also today, South Koreans are already among the hardest workers on the planet, and now the government is pushing for even longer hours. Those who are just entering the workforce won't have it.
These young people say, no, that's not how it works.
And Vice President Harris joins superpowers around the globe courting African nations. In Ghana, they see what's going on.
And that is why we also need to take advantage of the status quo to advance our interests.
I'm Marco Werman, and when Lebanon experiments with daylight saving time, things get messy. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. We start the week in Israel, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is hitting pause on plans to overhaul the judiciary there. Since the start of this year, Israel has seen massive protests, but in the last couple of days, things really escalated. Last night, crowds of demonstrators set fires and blocked roads, including the main highway out of Tel Aviv. It appears that the demonstrators have won the battle, but not the war. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the latest, and he joins me. Matthew, things are moving very fast with this story. Where do things stand at the moment?
Yeah, this morning, Marco, Israelis woke up to more political chaos. There was more protest on the streets and something new, a nationwide strike. Flights were grounded at Ben-Gurion Airport today. There were workers staying home from universities and hospitals. And on top of that, there were tens of thousands of protesters gathering outside the Knesset building, that's Israel's parliament in Jerusalem. Then later this afternoon, news broke that the leader of a far-right political party, that's also part of the prime minister's coalition, had agreed to a temporary pause in this judicial reform plan. Not long after that, soon after 8 p.m. local time, Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the nation. He gave a short speech, and here he is speaking through an interpreter.
We cannot have a civil war. We are now on a path of a very dangerous collision in the Israeli society. It's in the midst of a crisis which jeopardizes the basic unity between us. And such a crisis commits all of us. It binds all of us to act responsibly.
Netanyahu said that his government will now wait until after the legislative break next month to take up this issue of judicial reform and, as he put it, to allow for dialogue.
So is Netanyahu simply offering a month-long postponement of what will essentially be the same showdown?
I think we'll have to wait and see, but at this point, that looks like a real possibility because the prime minister also said that his government will do what it was elected to do. His coalition partners have not backed down on this judicial reform idea. Among them, there are the religious ultra-nationalist supporters of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank. They are still saying that this judicial reform plan is on track, that it will be passed. Also, Marco, Netanyahu today in that speech thanked pro-government protesters who were heading into Jerusalem tonight to show their support for judicial reforms. He said to them, no one will silence us.
Now, part of the background here is that Netanyahu is facing ongoing corruption charges. His personal political survival may be embedded in this entire crisis. Is his future as prime minister on the line here?
Absolutely. If these judicial reform plans go through as they stand now, this would give the prime minister and his coalition partners in parliament key powers over Israel's Supreme Court. That's the bottom line for many of these protesters. They say that this move would hobble the judiciary and it would undercut Israel's democratic system. Earlier today, we spoke with political scientist Reuven Hazan from Hebrew University, and he points out that it's not just left-leaning Israelis who are concerned about this judicial reform plan. It's also people from the political center and from the right, even people who supported Netanyahu and his Likud party in the last election.
They don't see him doing this for the good of the country. Actually, quite the opposite. There are quite a lot of people who now understand that Netanyahu is doing what is good for Netanyahu, even if it's not good for the country, and maybe not even good for his party, because they're losing support in the polls from week to week.
As we heard earlier, Matthew, Netanyahu said there will not be civil war, and that is a concern. There are some suggestions that the chaos of recent weeks has put Israel's national security at risk. What do you think?
There was a quote from the chief of staff of the army today who said that Israel has never faced this sort of simultaneous challenge with this internal chaos and the external threats. The other thing that's, I think, has been really telling here is for weeks now, we've heard about reservists in the Israeli military, hundreds of them who've said, look, I feel so strongly that this judicial reform cannot go through that I'm not going to show up for reserve duty. And remember that in Israel, this is serving in the military is sort of across the political spectrum, left, right, and center, just a revered, almost like a sacred duty. And just to see even people in uniform at some of these protests standing there, taking part and really standing up and saying to the government, no, we're not going to allow what they see as a real threat to the democratic system to continue. So this really does feel unprecedented for Israelis right now.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Vice President Kamala Harris is visiting countries in Africa this week. Her first stop, the West African nation of Ghana, which is grappling with a debt crisis and soaring inflation. It's also dealing with the threats from instability across the region. From the capital, Accra, reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman spoke with young Ghanaians about their hopes for the country's relationship with the U.S.
Vice President Kamala Harris wears a broad smile as she steps down on the tarmac at the Kotoka Airport in Accra. She is received by Ghana's Vice President Mahmoud Bawumia and an enthusiastic crowd, including school children, waving miniature Ghanaian and American flags.
When I look at what is happening on this continent and the fact that the median age is 19 years old, and what that tells us about the growth of opportunity, of innovation, I see in all of that great opportunity, not only for the people of this continent, but the people of the world.
Youth entrepreneurship is one of the focuses of Harris's trip. Young people in Africa currently face massive unemployment.
We need to consciously draw programs for young entrepreneurs in technology and innovation within our country.
Caleb Fuga is co-founder of Dex Technology Limited, a small company that is into innovative solutions to enhance science and technology education in Ghana.
Technology and innovation is the only leapfrogging opportunity we can get to catch up with advanced economies. We can't rely on our gold, nor can we rely on our petrol.
Young Ghanaians are not only concerned with economic opportunities.
Particularly, you know, in the United States, we all know of the recent declaration by the Supreme Court on the Roe and Wade, you know, abortion situation, and how this also had different implications for different African countries.
Thus, Richard Mauto Jikunu, a Ghanaian sustainable development advocate, he argues that if there is one area that vividly sums up Africa's development challenges, it is the field of health. He says Africa carries 25% of the world's disease burden, but its share of the global health expenditure is less than 1%.
Again, the spotlight on Ghana offers an opportunity that Ghana could leverage, you know, to also, you know, negotiate more or to also seek more assistance when it comes to support for global health.
Of course, the U.S. has its own interests on this trip. Adib Sani is an international relations analyst in Accra.
China has really asserted their influence in Africa, in trade and commerce, and even in the construction industry. The Russians are also providing security assistance to many countries.
Sani says that the vice president has been sent to the continent to counter this fast-growing competition.
So it's clearly an indication of the unique opportunities that the continent has to offer. That is why everybody seems to be scrambling, and that is why we also need to take advantage of the status quo to advance our interests.
Harris is set to announce $139 million in U.S. assistance for Ghana. Tonight, the American vice president will be feted at a state banquet with President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo and First Lady Rebecca Akufo-Addo. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
In South Korea, working people put in more hours than just about any other developed country. But the government in Seoul is considering a proposal to make their work week even longer, up to 69 hours. This is not going over well with the public. In fact, the backlash has been so fierce that South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, who has promoted extreme work hours himself, says he will reconsider the plan. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story. Patrick, how hard is the average South Korean working like right now, and how does the government play a role in that?
Yeah, so at the moment, by law, the work week in South Korea is supposed to max out at 52 hours, and that applies to everyone, civil servants, private companies, everyone. And you might think 52 hours doesn't sound too crazy, but that cap is not very well enforced. And also, it only kicked in 5 years ago. People demanded it 5 years ago in part because overwork was killing more than 100 people per year in South Korea. The Koreans even have a word for it, gwarosa, death by overwork. So South Korea's current president, President Yoon, came on board last year. He's very right-wing, very pro-business guy, and he is agitated to get that work week back up to 69 hours per week, which is very high.
I mean, 52 hours is still 12 hours longer than our 40-hour standard work week. If an even longer work week is so unpopular in South Korea, why would the government want to push it through?
There are a couple reasons. South Korea is very much under the sway of huge corporations. They have a very strong business lobby. There's also this huge divide between how young and old people view work. I spoke with a professor at Seoul National University, Sungho Shin, and Professor Shin said, the president at 62 years old comes from this generation that hustled really hard to turn South Korea from a poor, struggling country to a very modern country. And the professor thinks this older generation's work-till-you-drop mindset is stuck in the 80s.
They still think about the 80s when people were working until like midnight and there was no holiday. It's like a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then Friday, Monday.
Wow. So how are younger South Koreans reacting to this? You know, the people who would be putting in more years slogging away at this proposed 69-hour work week.
Yeah, well, by and large, they're pretty upset regardless of political orientation. Even conservatives who like the president's business-friendly approach are saying 69 hours really is too much. Even though other politicians behind the scenes have agitated to make this work week longer, President Yoon is becoming the face of it, in part because he's made these statements in the past, like, what's wrong with working 120 hours a week? So he kind of owns it now. Professor Sheen told me that the president is now the target of everyone's backlash, causing the president to maybe reconsider this whole policy.
These young people say, no, that's not how it works. There's a political backlash, so he's trying to correct the situation at the moment. He's backtracking.
So, Patrick, where do things stand like right now with this proposal for a 69-hour work week?
Right now, it's up in the air. The president is backtracking. He's saying it may need some modification. Another problem is, Marco, it's out of sync with other government priorities. So South Korea is pressuring young people to have kids, and the fertility rate in the country is dangerously low. And many young people are saying, well, hold on, how can we raise kids if we're working almost 70 hours a week? Something has to give.
The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen speaking with us from Bangkok. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
For a few weird hours today, Lebanon tried operating on two time zones. The result is what our guest calls malignant incompetence. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In the Rwandan capital, Kigali, Paul Rusesabagina has been released from prison. Rusesabagina was portrayed as the hero of the Hollywood feature film Hotel Rwanda. It tells the story of how Rusesabagina helped save the lives of more than 1,000 people during the Rwandan genocide by housing them in a luxury hotel he managed at the time. 2 years ago, Rusesabagina was convicted and given a long prison sentence. That created a lot of tension between the U.S. and Rwanda. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi is following the latest. Remind us, Halima, how and why Paul Rusesabagina ended up in a Rwandan jail.
Sure. Well, this story is film-worthy in its own right. Rusesabagina had been living with his family in the United States for years, where he'd been lauded as a hero for saving more than 1,000 people during the Rwandan genocide. And over time, he had also become a vocal critic of the government of President Paul Kagame. And because of that, he had a target on his back for a number of years. Then in 2020, he was traveling to Dubai, and his family lost contact with him. Then a couple days later, the Rwanda investigation Bureau said that he was in their custody in Rwanda, a place that his family said he would have never gone to willingly. At the time, the family said that he had been kidnapped. Later on, human rights groups said that it had been a forced disappearance, and even the president of Rwanda, Kagame, had alluded that the government had tricked him into coming back into Rwanda, and officials said that he was wanted on accusations of terrorist activities.
I mean, terrorist activities, it's a far cry from saving lives in the 1994 genocide. What does that mean, terrorist activities? It's a serious accusation. Were they true?
Well, it's very complicated. I mean, first off, these accusations of terrorism against Rusesabagina go back many years, and they largely stem from his association with the Rwandan Movement for Democratic Change, or MRCD for short. And this is a coalition of opposition groups that oppose the Rwandan government. And this group, coalition of groups, also has an armed wing, which has been linked to violence. So this is where the terrorism accusations come up, because the Rwandan government considers MRCD a terrorist group. That said, Rusesabagina has said he does not condone political violence. And at the same time, Rwanda's government does have a track record of going after dissidents with unfair and untrue claims and targeting them abroad. And so that's why there's been a lot of skepticism throughout his trial. Nonetheless, 2 years ago, a Rwandan court sentenced Rusesabagina with 25 years on terrorism-related charges. And many people considered his trial to have been unfair. Some said it was a sham. The United States said that he was being unfairly detained. And throughout this whole process, there's been a lot of criticism on Rwanda.
It was a surprise to many last week when Kigali made the announcement that Rusesabagina was about to be released. How did that end up happening?
Well, there's been a lot of pressure from the beginning from a number of countries, including the United States, on this matter. U.S. officials have been meeting with Rwandan counterparts about the issue and also making statements publicly and condemning the Rwandan government for his arrest and then for his reported treatment while he was in prison. The case and then his sentencing has created a lot of tension between the U.S. and Rwanda over the past few years. And at the end of last year, Rusesabagina wrote a letter requesting a pardon so that he could return home to the United States with his family. And ultimately, he was granted clemency by President Kagame. But it does seem like at the end of the day, it was those tensions between the U.S. and Rwanda over this issue that contributed to his release. One revealing statement that was made was by a Rwandan press secretary who said that the release of Rusesabagina came from a shared desire to reset the U.S.-Rwanda relationship. So we'll see if that happens.
The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi in Nairobi. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
In Lebanon, crisis seems not to be a bug, but a feature. The country's financial crisis, the worst in its history, has no end in sight. There's also Lebanon's perpetual political crisis. Now, crisis number three, politicians literally playing with time. Late last week, Lebanon's cabinet decided to delay the shift to daylight savings time by a month. The early results were disastrous. Sami Zuhaib in Beirut can explain what happened. He's an economist and researcher with the Policy Initiative, a Lebanese think tank. If it's not one thing, it's another, Sami. A decision by the Lebanese cabinet on daylight savings time ended in chaos. What happened? Walk us through it.
The cabinet here in Lebanon took a decision last week to not go with daylight saving time because of Ramadan, actually, with the point being that with a shorter day, then people would be fasting earlier. And Ramadan, for those who don't know, Muslims usually fast from sunrise to sunset, so, which is not practically something that the cabinet can decide. But however, they decided to go forward with the decision, and it led to great chaos. Today, actually, the decision was rescinded, and we'll go back to normal daylight saving time on Thursday.
But while this ruling was alive and the law of the land for a while, how confusing was this for Lebanese? I mean, any stories of people showing up to school or work off by an hour?
In school, some schools decided it was really like up to the school or institution itself to choose the time that they wanted to go with. So some schools, for example, would have the time with DST. Others would go with the government decision. That made that, for example, some parents that had to drive their kids to school and then go to work would either have to take their kids an hour earlier or an hour later. And that wouldn't really work because their work would have been different. So it led to all sorts of issues.
And it's Ramadan. This was a decision by the state that impacted religion. Were Muslim clerics consulted before the cabinet ruled? And what's been the reaction from Muslim leaders?
It really didn't make much sense, even to the clerics that I've really listened to kind of comment on this issue. Some clerics who really kind of are involved in some of the more identitarian politics, you know, religious politics in Lebanon, took a stance that is pro the decision just to make a point and not really, because at the end of the day, it turned into a bit of a Christian-Muslim competition of sorts.
I'm glad you brought up that point. I mean, there is a sizable Christian population in Lebanon and not everyone fasts during Ramadan. So talk more about those sectarian consequences.
Some of the leaders of the Christian community in Lebanon said, okay, no one consulted with us. Why should we have our schedules all mixed up together so we can let the Muslims fast? This doesn't make any sense. You guys have been ruling the country on your own. And so it really took the narrative all the way to this Muslim-Christian fault line that exists in society and that's usually played on by political leaders.
Sami, it occurs to me that keeping the clocks running, it's a metaphor of efficiency. And I wonder if this little incident ended up by making a big impression on the public, leaving them with even less confidence in their government.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because it really shows that decisions in Lebanon are not really made based on any kind of real evaluation or assessment of the situation. And this is something that not only affects time here, but, you know, even when it comes to the exchange rate, you know, we have multiple exchange rates in this country, which really shows the level of malignant incompetence of the leadership here in Lebanon, which is really leaving the people even less trusting of the government, which has mishandled not only this file, but also multiple files in the past years.
Sami Suhaib is an economist and researcher with the Policy Initiative in Beirut. Thank you very much, Sami. Good to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. In the 60s, many young American men said no to the draft. In Canada, they rebuilt their lives and their new homes.
That was the top of my vision for my life, was living in these mountains, planting trees, hook, line, and sinker. Jimmy Boy is now a Canadian.
The legacy of people like him who became tree planters and teachers and mayors in Canada, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than a year ago, athletes from Russia, as well as Belarus, have largely been banned from international competitions. But now some sports federations are paving the way for those athletes to return to the field of play, and that possibility is now leaving Ukrainian participation up in the air. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Olga Karlan got out of Ukraine just in time.
I came to Bologna 16th of February, so I got lucky.
The four-time Olympic fencer happened to move to Italy to work with a new coach just 8 days before the war started. Her parents and grandparents were still in Mykolaiv, which has since faced countless bombings and widespread blackouts. From Italy, Carlan felt helpless.
I couldn't do anything, you know. I always been on the phone with them, my parents, but it was sometimes impossible. There wasn't connections.
The stress impacted her fencing results, too. But she tried to keep things in perspective.
I said to myself, you are not a robot, apparently, you know. So I wasn't disappointed.
Lately, Carlan says she has started feeling stronger and her fencing has improved. Her family remains in Ukraine. And her mom recently started feeling safe enough to sleep on her home's second floor instead of in the basement because the threat of bombs has decreased. Still, they don't have access to clean drinking water, and Carlan can't stop worrying about them. Thousands of Ukrainian athletes and their families are facing these conditions. Vadim Gutsait is the president of Ukraine's National Olympic Committee and the country's minister of sport. Through a translator, he tells me the situation is a nightmare.
Ну, відчуття взагалі, ну, коли гинуть люди, це саме життя, це саме головне, що є у кожної людини.
Gutsait says more than 3,000 Ukrainian athletes have joined their country's armed forces. 262 have died in action. Other athletes and coaches have lost children and loved ones to Russian missiles.
Вже рік іде війна, і наші спортсмени, багато хто з Харкова.
He says a few sports facilities remain open across Ukraine, but the athletes who could have moved abroad. Some wrestlers, curlers, skiers, and track and field athletes have come to the U.S., receiving everything from meals to housing to equipment. Other athletes have headed to Turkey or Germany.
Everyone who came and said, I want to train here, was provided support.
Michael Scherp is a spokesperson for the German Olympic Sports Confederation.
We have about 50 Ukrainian athletes from different sports that via private connections and the coach knew the coach and they all ended up where they could go on with their training.
Scherp says for the first year, Germany's sports federations funded Ukrainian athletes in need. Now in the war's second year, the federal government is stepping in to help.
There are special measures for elite athletes, the training facilities, the possibility to get help from the physiotherapists and the doctors.
Many of these Ukrainian athletes are gearing up for the 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris. The International Olympic Committee has not yet announced whether they will allow Russians and Belarusians to participate in those games. But governing bodies for each sport are now starting to decide if they'll welcome those athletes in the upcoming qualifying tournaments. Some leaders, like World Athletics President Sebastian Coe, are standing firm on the ban.
Athletes, officials, and supporting personnel from Russia and Belarus are still excluded from competition for the foreseeable future due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
But the International Fencing Federation is welcoming the athletes back starting next month. In response, Ukraine's National Fencing Federation is boycotting those tournaments. Fencer Olga Karlan isn't sure how to feel about the decision.
Of course, for each athlete, like, it's a goal to go to Olympic Games. But right now, it's really tough to imagine how I can fence against them, you know.
Sport Minister Vadim Gutsait says the vast majority of Ukrainian athletes he's spoken with are in favor of boycotting if the IOC lets Russians and Belarusians into the next Olympics. As head of the Ukrainian Olympic Committee, he too is adamantly opposed to their participation. Gutsait says he will only feel comfortable with Russian and Belarusian athletes competing under a neutral flag if they meet strict criteria, including publicly denouncing Russia's aggression against Ukraine. The IOC has been vague on what they would consider a neutral athlete. They're expected to announce guidance on including Russian and Belarusian athletes in upcoming tournaments tomorrow. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
For international artists and musicians looking to tour in the U.S., things could soon become harder. They may need to shell out extra cash for a visa to perform here, a fee that could be too steep for many artists. Matthew Covey is a lawyer, musician, festival organizer, and advocate for bringing international artists to the United States. He joins us from New York. Matthew, first off, this visa fee, explain what it's all about.
Well, when you're trying to get a visa for an international artist to come to the U.S., when a U.S. presenter wants to bring an international artist to the U.S., the first step in the process is to file a petition with U.S. Homeland Security. And that petition currently costs $460. That's the government fee that gets paid to the government to process that petition. And the proposed rule change would increase that fee to somewhere around $1,600. And the fee proposal is applicable all across the boards.
That's a huge increase. What would an artist have to go through if this proposal is approved?
It doesn't change the procedures very much. It just means that they're going to have to pay more when this form is submitted to the government. The background of this is that USCIS, which is the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, is largely self-funded. So the activities that they undertake and the work that they do, the cost of that work needs to be covered by the fees that they charge. But also a significant chunk of that fee increase, about $600, is a fee which funds the U.S.'s asylum program, which is not really related in any way to the actual workers who are coming. It's just the realization that asylum seekers aren't a great source of funding, and so they've got to figure out where to get those funds from other fees.
You work with a lot of performers and artists around the globe. An increase in visa fees, the kind that's being proposed, who will it affect the most?
The fee increase, which is roughly $1,200 when a petition is filed, is not going to affect, you know, stadium superstars. You know, $1,200 plus or minus is a drop in the bucket for their budgets. But there's an enormous sector of the culture that comes to the U.S., that U.S. festivals, theaters, dance companies, orchestras, and clubs, a large sector of the artists that those U.S. arts presenters bring in are functioning really on a shoestring, or the profitability of those performances or those tours are really on a knife edge. And so to add a cost in, especially in the context of kind of the post-COVID recovery of the performing arts, is a really big hit. And it's going to do one of two things. Either it's going to make a lot of tours no longer viable, or it's going to hand over those tours to larger corporations, largely international arts organizations or entertainment organizations that have the deeper pockets that can cover that extra cost.
When acts tour in other countries, do they have to pay similar visa fees there?
No, not at all. The U.S. is, for the most part, I think it's kind of unrivaled in terms of the cost and complexity of bringing an artist into the country. There aren't other countries in the world that have, or certainly not countries where U.S. artists tour frequently, that have bureaucratic and financial barriers like the ones that we have to the U.S.
I mean, the visa fee is not a done deal. If it is approved, when would it take effect?
It's not a done deal at all. The USCIS has done what they are required to do, which is seek advice and comment from the public regarding the proposal. And they received really an avalanche of comments, both from arts organizations and artists within the U.S., but also internationally.
Matthew Covey is a lawyer who assists international artists in the visa process to perform in the U.S. He joined us from New York. Matthew, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The former president of Taiwan, Ma Ying-jeou, flew to Shanghai today. That makes him the first Taiwanese leader to set foot in mainland China since the Chinese Civil War ended in 1949. A couple of days from now, the current president, Tsai Ing-wen, is leaving for a trip to the Americas. All this at the same time Taiwan is getting ready for upcoming presidential elections. From Taipei, Ashish Valentine reports on how that vote is linked to these two high-profile overseas missions.
Ma Ying-jeou held a press conference just before getting on the plane to Shanghai. He's taking 30 Taiwanese students along for the trip. I hope through young people's enthusiasm, we can improve the current atmosphere in cross-strait relations and bring peace to this place more quickly. Ma led Taiwan from 2008 to 2016. Cao Chendong, a professor of political science at National Taiwan University, says he was known for improving relations with China.
Ma Ying-jeou's tenure marks the most stable and peaceful time in cross-strait relations since the late 1940s.
Cao says Ma's getting old, and it's traditional for someone like him, whose family left China after the Civil War, to want to go back and honor his ancestors. He said there's also a political reason, diffusing tensions that have built up in recent years.
The best strategy is to have the two societies seeing positive side from the other side.
But opinions in Taiwan are divided on Ma's visit. Max Yu's former dean of the Political Warfare Academy at Taiwan's National Defense University. He says China timed the visit to undermine the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, which favors Taiwanese sovereignty.
This event, of course, will attract attention. This is, I think, congruent with China's narrative power competition prior to Tsai Ing-wen's, planned visit to United States.
Yu says China wants to use Ma's visit to convince Taiwan's voters that only his party, the KMT, can negotiate with China to deliver peace in the Taiwan Strait. At the same time, he says, China's escalating its threats to Taiwan while it's under the current ruling party.
They create kind of fear of war factors in Taiwan through continued increase in military intimidation tactics. And that actually affect neutral voters.
He argues China also timed another event to embarrass Taiwan's current president. Today, Honduras officially began diplomatic relations with China at a ceremony in Beijing, ending its relations with Taiwan. China's foreign minister, Qin Gang, said his government was happy with Honduras' decision. That brings Taiwan down to only 13 official diplomatic allies. The move came just days before President Tsai Ing-wen was scheduled to visit the United States to meet with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, as well as visit several Central American allies of Taiwan. President Tsai released a video message yesterday as Taiwan responded by ending relations with Honduras. We will not engage in meaningless dollar diplomacy with China, she says. In the past few years, China has constantly used various methods to suppress Taiwan's international participation. Taiwan's lost a total of 9 diplomatic allies since Tsai Ing-wen took office in 2016. Political scientist Zhou Chendong says China was much less aggressive during Ma's presidency. However, Taiwan's unofficial relationships with allies are growing. In the wake of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, nearby countries Lithuania and the Czech Republic have boosted ties with Taiwan, in spite of Chinese pressure. As Tsai prepares for her trip to the Americas and Taiwan for its next election, the symbolism of events like these could weigh on voters' decisions. For The World, this is Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
The gang violence in Haiti that has even overwhelmed their own police has gotten worse in recent weeks. This month alone, at least 200 people there have been killed in gang warfare. The kidnapping and ransom business is thriving and making gangs even more powerful. During President Biden's recent visit to Canada, he spoke with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau about the possibility of military intervention. Trudeau was reluctant. For more on this, we turn to Ambassador Daniel Foote, former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti. Ambassador, I'd like to ask you the straightforward question. What are the reasons for and against a foreign intervention in Haiti? And if you would, start with the case for intervention.
The case for intervention has become much more clear in recent months. People living in Haiti with whom I speak daily, who don't believe in intervention ideologically, are now calling for help. They need help to stop the bleeding and to return the lives to some of these Haitian people.
What are the arguments against intervention?
Every time the U.S. or the internationals have done this, it's failed and Haiti has wound up worse off at the end of the day. If the U.S. or Canada leads a military intervention to Haiti while Ariel Henry is the de facto prime minister, he was named by the U.S. and Canada, I fear that the peacekeepers may come into conflict directly with the Haitian people who are united against the illegitimate Ariel Henry. The long-term results of military intervention have always been a much worse off Haiti at the end of the day. The U.S. Marines went there in 1915. They administered the country, ran it, governed it for 19 years. Until 1934, they moved all the gold from Haiti up to New York City, and a number of massacres and extrajudicial killings, and it didn't go well for the Haitians.
So as we saw President Biden go to Canada last week, speak with the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau about all of this, I feel like I want to know what the U.S. actually wants to do.
I believe that the United States is between a rock and a hard place. And they want Haiti to return to being stable, but they, at this point, don't want to make any decisions or implement anything. At the end of the day, the United States wants security to be good enough to hold elections that are acceptable to the Haitian people.
And why is there reluctance on Trudeau's part?
Prime Minister Trudeau has looked at history and understands that it's a losing bet to lead a military intervention in Haiti.
What kinds of intervention options exist?
UN peacekeeping operations is what's been done in the past. And that takes 18 months to 2 years to set up. And everyone is against that right now. At this point, I think the United States is looking for a more agile, smaller force to go in, maybe several hundred with appropriate equipment and transportation and armor, and open up a humanitarian corridor. And I think that that could work if they, at the same time, are enabling the Haitians to pick their way forward. Then back that government at their request. If we go in under Ariel Henry, we're going to wind up running the country again.
Ambassador Daniel Foote is a former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
This week marks 50 years since the departure of the last U.S. troops from Vietnam. More than 2 million American men were drafted to fight. Many who were called up refused to go. Instead, as many as 100,000 Americans fled to Canada, to cities like Vancouver and Toronto. Others found their way to remote towns just on the other side of the porous U.S.-Canadian border. Reporter Jimmy Thompson in Victoria, British Columbia, has this story about Americans who resisted the draft and the lasting impact they made on their adopted home.
It's been more than five decades, but Jim Holland, who was living in Houston, still remembers when the phone call came in.
He's going, James Holland. I said, yeah. He says, this is something, Jordan. He says, I'm the chair of Local Board 59, and this is on Thursday night. He said, son, I'm holding your orders in my hand right now. He said, in 2 weeks, you're going to be wearing army boots at Fort Hood.
Army boots wouldn't have exactly suited his style back then. He dressed like a hippie and wore his hair long, so long that people used to chase him around with scissors threatening to cut it off. Holland ended up in the rolling mountains of the West Kootenays in British Columbia, just north of Idaho's Panhandle. He got a job working in forestry. He found what he calls his people.
That was it, man. I thought that was the top of my vision for my life. Was living in these mountains, planting trees. What, you know, just hook, line, and sinker. That's it. Jimmy Boy is now Canadian.
But his easy integration into Canada wasn't everyone's experience. Gary Wright was a student activist from a conservative family in Montana. He says he fled to Canada in 1968 after the FBI put him on a watch list, and it wasn't easy in the beginning.
So there was the usual number of fist fights, car burnings, you know, arguments on street corner, boycotting of businesses back and forth between the different groups.
Kathleen Rogers, sociologist and author of Welcome to Resisterville, says there was a culture clash.
More than the fact that they were American was the fact that they were countercultural and they represented this entirely new way of living. People there that had been there for generations were fairly conservative, had conservative values, and this group did not.
The Kootenays were home to a shrinking population of miners and loggers, and the draft dodgers dressed, acted, and sounded different from the Canadians who had lived in that part of the province. At one point, the Canadian census found that a quarter of the immigrants in that region were from the U.S. But in time, the newcomers settled in. Here's Wright again.
Within a generation, it resulted in intermarriage. And so all those people are now pretty well related to each other.
As they built their lives in their adoptive country, the war resistors and draft dodgers became teachers, politicians, environmental activists. Towns throughout the region owe their charm to Bob Inwood, a war resister who became an architect. He oversaw the restoration of historic downtown buildings that give these places their character. Wright spent two decades as mayor of New Denver, BC. He was honored by the Canadian government for his long and exemplary service to his community. Holland, who fled from Texas, became the mayor of nearby Caslow, BC.
we got into office, and I think in general, promote a policy of active local government.
Canada at the time welcomed the draft Dodgers, happy for a large influx of educated English speakers. But there were people on both sides of the border who thought that some of the enthusiasm went too far. In 2004, a group in Nelson, British Columbia, proposed erecting a statue to memorialize Canadians reaching out to help fleeing Americans. It caused an immediate uproar. Veterans groups in the United States threatened boycotts of the tourism-dependent city.
I think a lot of the negative attention came from kind of talk radio in the United States. Like, how could they be commemorating? Basically, how could they be commemorating cowards?
Eventually, the city rejected the statue. Some of the draft dodgers themselves breathed a sigh of relief. They were uncomfortable with the attention and with the idea of making trouble in their adoptive home. In 1977, President Jimmy Carter pardoned hundreds of thousands of young men who had evaded the draft. Americans could now return home and not face prison. Yet, half the people who went to Canada ended up staying. It changed both countries forever. For the world, I'm Jimmy Thompson in Victoria, British Columbia.
The withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam 50 years ago meant that Vietnamese soldiers had to train up fast to take their place. Tomorrow, we'll hear from a Vietnamese pilot who was rushed into service so the U.S. military could leave. Also coming up tomorrow, we take you to the National Museum of Cambodia as they welcome back a statue that was stolen from a temple 20 years ago.
Oh, I never imagined such a huge sculpture.
It's part of the global effort to return antiquities to their places of origin. Those stories and more tomorrow here on The World. The London record label Mayis says it represents musicians who fuse styles, disregard genres, and reshape tradition. No surprise, then, that Ghanaian singer Linda Iapuka is with the label. She handily checks off all three boxes. Iapuka hails from the north of Ghana. She grew up in a Christian home, attending church, and following in her mother's footsteps as a gospel singer. She's gone on to great acclaim in that world, but not exactly following her mother's style. Faith is still a key part of Iapuka's music, but she also incorporates frafra, an improvisational style of song and dance, popular in that part of Ghana. So yes, she's reshaping traditions. You could say Iapuka is unclassifiable. Anyone who is remotely familiar with 1980s synth pop will wonder how that found its way into West African gospel music. There's that, and her music is not what you'd expect from gospel. That's because it's dressed up as Ghanaian frafra music. Credit that to Iapuka's producer, Francis Ayamga, also from northern Ghana, who has taken the ceremonial music of the region's frafra ethnic group and zapped it into the digital world. An unlikely fusion from a powerful duo of talent and production, one that has hooked many listeners in Ghana. World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong, catch you again tomorrow.